The Tom Woods Show, episode 1993.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. Today's episode is brought to you by Ignite. With Ignite, your small to medium-sized business can share files securely, safe from ransomware, and with a user-friendly interface your team will love. Start your free trial today at ignite.com. That's EGNYTE.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Make sure you stick around after my interview today because I do want to say a little something about the 2000th episode of the program, which we recorded this past weekend at a big event in Orlando, and it will be released when the moment for episode 2000 has arrived. And it's just as well because we have a little work to do on it. But I do want to say a little bit about that, but we'll do that after my conversation with Bjorn Lomborg, who became an international name with his 2001 book, The Skeptical Environmentalist. And today, we're going to talk to him about his more recent book that was released just last year in 2020, but which comes out in paperback this very week, False Alarm: How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet. Now, Lomborg believes that the planet is warming and that it's due primarily to human activity, but he does not believe that the catastrophic scenarios being described are either accurate or helpful. So that's the standpoint he's coming from, and I thought it'd be useful for you to know that as we begin the conversation. Bjorn, welcome to the show.
Hey, Thomas, it's great to be here.
Let me start off with something. Of course, I want to spend 99% of the time talking about your book, but every once in a while, I have somebody on who is kind of in your camp, who is concerned about the environment and has spent his life being concerned about it, but is also concerned about exaggeration of threats and speaks against that and explains that, of course, we have to understand there are trade-offs to everything we do, that, of course, we would like to accomplish X, Y, and Z, but we realize that that does come at the cost of A, B, and C, and we have to decide according to our own values whether one is worth the other. You know, trying to speak rationally as opposed to in apocalyptic terms. But at the same time, is there a part of you that is concerned that you wind up, do you feel like you've been exploited by right-wing sources that don't care about the environment at all, but they can point to you and say, aha, look at this environmentalist agrees with us, and this environmentalist says we don't need to do A, B, and C. Is there any concern that that happens?
So it's a good question, Thomas. I love the way that you just summarized everything I do. And let me just first take off on that, because fundamentally, what I try to do with my organization and pretty much everything I've done is to say, it's important that we don't just focus on the issues that, if you will, have the best PR. So some issues are much, much more obvious to get into the front pages of newspapers, but there are lots of other places where just a little money could do an amazing amount of good, both for the environment and especially for humans that are still suffering in all kinds of very, very avoidable ways around the world. So, you know, just one fact, the biggest infectious disease killer is tuberculosis, not right now because of COVID, but pretty much every year. And yet we don't really care about it. And one of the points that I try to make is, look, for very little money, you could save almost 1.5 million people. Why are we not talking more about that? But then to your question, there is undoubtedly, when you point out, look, some of the things that you hear about global warming are vastly overblown. For some reason or another, it obviously ends up making you more likely to spend more money on climate change and then less money on all the other problems, including TB. Some people will exploit that. But that's true in every area and for every statement. And obviously, it's also true that a lot of people are exploiting the exaggeration in climate and the lack of focus on TB in pretty much all other areas. I'm simply making the point that if you make the best effort to present data so that you understand well what are our options, you're more likely to help make for good policy. Sure, people will also exploit stuff, but my point is to tell as much as I can the full truth, and then, of course, it's up to everyone to make their vote in their national elections.
All right, that's about as good an answer as I suppose I could have asked for. So, all right, and of course, I'd love to spend some time talking about the controversy about the skeptical environmentalist 20 years on, but that's a separate episode. Let's talk about this matter of climate change. Now, in particular, you're talking in the book in part about the hysteria, the irrationality around it, the apocalyptic predictions and things of this sort. And I guess I want to know, why do you think there are some issues in our society that provoke this type of response? And I can think of, well, I mean, I don't know where you stand, but I personally think that the COVID policy we've had is almost exactly analogous to what you're describing here, a sense that there's only one thing to be concerned about, and we'll pile all our efforts at that, whether or not the methods we're using are actually showing any results. But we're going to feel good about ourselves if the things we do are at least purported to help. And we're going to act as if there's no collateral damage that we need to worry about because this is the only thing. I'd like to know why people are inclined to go down that route. Mm-hmm. And do you think this is a matter of people with good intentions have just gone awry? Or do you think these are people with bad intentions who are exploiting a particular cause to make themselves more powerful? What's actually going on here?
So, Thomas, I think two very brief answers. One is I would love to know what's going on as well. And the second thing is my sense is always most people, certainly most people I've ever met, are motivated by good intentions. So I don't think any of the people that I debate want to do evil things. I'm sure there are also evil people out there, but most people really do want to do well. And I think also it serves us well, just as human beings, to take that as our starting point for making any kind of conversation. So I think that a lot of people are really worried about a number of issues. Obviously, being worried also gives you a sense of purpose in your life. It also gives you a sense of rightness and rightfulness in your life that can be very rewarding in many ways. And so clearly, you know, when we talk about, for instance, COVID, you just mentioned that. I live in Sweden now, and we've obviously been in a very different society than most other countries in the rich world. My organization did some of the first cost-benefit analyses for poor countries, because remember, one of the points is if you're in a rich country, you can't afford to flatten the curve and to basically keep people socially distant for a long time. But that's not so in poor countries. And what we found was that you would end up leaving poor countries much worse off if they did the same policies as rich countries did. And indeed, that's also what most poor countries have found out, either involuntarily like India, but also many other countries that we advised, for instance, Uganda and Malawi and Ghana, that decided not to lock down nearly strongly because the costs actually outweigh the benefits for a variety of reasons. And this is not predominantly what we're talking about, but it is important to be able to look beyond your, this makes me feel good, so I'm only going to have this one vision of the world. So on climate, it is a problem. It is something that we should be concerned about. Overall, climate change will have a negative impact on humanity, but it's important to say this is not going to be the end of the world. The UN Climate Panel, the IPCC, estimates in their 2018 report, if we do nothing against climate change, by the end of the century, the net impact will be equivalent to losing 2.6% of global GDP. Remember, by then, each person will be about 450% as rich as he or she is today. That's their own central estimate. So instead of being 450% as rich, it will feel like we're only 434% as rich. And that is a problem. It's also important to say that's not the end of the world. It's actually still a much better world, but obviously we can work to make it even better. I think this understanding that global warming is a problem, but it's not the end of the world. Global warming rather inhibits our progress towards a better world. It makes it better, slightly slower. That's an important one because the first one is the end of the world. Obviously, it makes us want to throw everything in the kitchen sink at it. Whereas the second, and I think the right way to look at this as an inhibitor of human progress, makes us understand it's one of the many things that stand in the way of making better life. And so we need to make sure that we actually deal with it, but deal with it smartly.
I want to ask you something in all sincerity. This is not an attempt to be a troll. I genuinely would like to know the answer. It seems to me that if the global temperature increases by, you know, X degrees, that it's certainly possible that this could harm some people, some industries, some crops. But at the same time, isn't it possible at least that there could be some aspects of human life that are improved by a slightly warmer temperature? I don't understand why it should be that all the consequences would be negative, that we're so fragile that even a relatively tiny movement of temperature is catastrophically bad. I mean, of course, and I know you're not claiming that it's catastrophically bad, but is there anything on the other side of the ledger?
Oh, of course there is. You know, global warming, like any other problem, has a variety of different outcomes, some of them positive, some of them negative. For global warming, they're more negative than positive. That's why it ends up net being a problem. But, you know, it's a fantasy world where you only have a problem that only makes bad stuff, or, you know, other policies that only make good stuff. In the real world, there's a mixture. So one obvious thing when you look at rising temperatures is that you get more heat waves with rising temperatures, which is obviously a negative. But you also obviously get fewer cold waves, which is an obvious positive. And I think it's just, it shows the conversation that we can't have an honest debate where we say, look, overall, in the long run, it's likely that the more heat waves are going to outweigh the less cold waves. Although right now, that's actually not the case because there's many, many more people dying from cold than from heat. So probably about 9 times more. So it's about 500,000 from heat and about 4.5 million people from cold. So we need to be honest about these impacts. The main reason why global warming is a problem is not that we will see many more, you know, hurricane catastrophes, because we know that as people become richer, they become more resilient, and hurricane disasters have fairly small and limited impacts, especially if you're wealthy and able to protect yourself and your societies. What will make the impact is basically the fact that all of our infrastructure is adjusted to the current temperature. So here in Europe, you know, people living in Helsinki and Finland are well adapted to a rather cold climate, and people in Athens and Greece are adapted to a fairly warm climate. If both of these places get warmer or indeed colder, they would have a problem simply because their infrastructure is no longer adjusted to where they are now placed. That's the main reason why global warming is a problem, that we move away from the place where we built our infrastructure to, so the temperature that we had the last 200 years. That's the problem. And that's, of course, a solvable problem. It's not going to be cost-free, but it's not going to be the end of the world either.
Right. You do have a section where you use the word adaptation.
Yes.
You talk about that.
Well, and it's one of those frustrating things. Of course we'll adapt. You know, when people talk about sea levels rising, again, remember, there's very little positive spin to sea levels rising. That's just one of the things that are just bad. But it's not the bad in the sense of most people sort of imagine this, and many research papers actually do the same. They imagine a world where we just fill up the bathtub of the oceans a little more, and that floods in over a lot of stuff that wasn't flooded before. But of course, this happens over the next 80 years, where we also will adapt. It's important to recognize that many places around the world, so we estimate about 110 million people already live underwater, if you will, in the sense that they live in, you know, the most well-known example is Holland, but also in London and in Vietnam and many other places around the world. People live in areas that are actually below sea level, but they live well because we know how to adapt. And again, what we have to remember is it's mostly poor people that are dramatically impacted and richer people are not. So the question is, do we help these future victims of sea level rise by cutting carbon emissions and hence still seeing sea levels rise, but slightly less? Or do we help them by getting them out of poverty? And much evidence actually indicates that getting them out of poverty not only has a lot of other benefits, but it's also a more effective way to help them deal with the climate problems that they will face.
Well, along those lines, you gave us a GDP figure to try to encapsulate some aspect of what maybe unchecked climate change would bring about economically. But in terms of natural phenomena that we would observe, not in economic statistics, but natural phenomena that we would observe that we would consider to be undesirable. In your view, what would that consist of? And in, let's say, a more hysterical view, what would that consist of?
Well, I'm not going to sit here and make the hysterical argument, but very clearly, we will have higher temperatures. That means we'll have, for instance, as we mentioned, more heat waves. We'll probably see fewer storms, but stronger storms, and stronger storms is worse than fewer, is better. So overall, we'll see more damage impact from storms. We will possibly see some drought. We'll possibly see some flood, but most of these things will be dramatically mediated by human development. So for instance, we can't actually tell that there's more floods right now. We can't tell that there's more drought. Actually, it looks like there's less drought so far. And then there's a few other things, you know, for instance, fire. In some areas, we might see more fire. But, you know, again, if you look at the global data, fire has been declining since 1901, where we have good data, and certainly been declining over the, we have 21 years of good satellite coverage, where it has been declining globally in terms of area burnt. Not because of climate change, but simply because humans know how to make stuff not burn, and they have a strong interest in doing so. So even the scenarios out in the future also estimate, this is also the EPA, estimate that we will see less burning in the future, not more. But if we choose a low carbon emission future, we will see even less compared to the high carbon future. So we can make a difference here. But of course, again, it's important to say what matters most is the adaptation and the human interventions that we will make by making sure that less stuff burns rather than the climate impact. And so the hysterical argument would probably more be, we're going to see more storms, we're going to see stronger storms, we're going to see more heat waves. We'll probably also see more cold waves, which is one of those arguments that I've never quite understood. You can, of course, make the argument that, you know, Texas, in some absurd, convoluted way, the Texas cold wave in February was actually due to climate change. But clearly, on average, you have to make sure that there is less cold. Otherwise, you just can't get global temperature to increase. So there's this disjunct idea of just everything getting worse. And I think that's the point that I try to battle, partly because it's false, but also partly because it makes it really hard for us to make good political judgments.
Hey folks, a big, big thank you to Ignite, our sponsor for this episode, which can help prevent you from suffering the catastrophic effects of ransomware attacks. We've seen all over the world, companies have their valuable digital files held hostage, and then they have to decide whether they want to pay these cyber criminals to get them back. And on average, it takes about 23 days to recover. So imagine 23 days of disruption and chaos and downtime, and it's small to medium-sized businesses that get hurt the worst. Well, Ignite is the first ever file system that has sophisticated ransomware detection and recovery tools fully baked in. So your teams can create and share documents in Microsoft 365, Google Docs, Slack, Salesforce, DocuSign, countless others, while keeping your company's data safe. And I can tell you, I've looked around it. Most security software has a terrible user experience. That's not at all the case with Ignite. This is a security tool teams will actually love using. Ransomware detection and mitigation run in the background so your team can work without disruption. You know exactly where key documents are and who has access, automatically detect more than 2,000 ransomware variants and flag unusual behaviors. And if ransomware does sneak through, you can restore your files fast and be back up and running in hours, not days, and without having to pay the bad guys one penny. Learn more about how Ignite can protect your business from ransomware. Start your free trial today at egnyte.com. That's egnyte.com. Well, speaking of good political judgments, you also say in the book that one of the reasons that the discussion of this issue has become almost unmanageable involves politics. That you say that some politicians will say, I'm defending you against a catastrophic outcome, and my opponent isn't. And attached to that is this worldview according to which if you favor the various public policies that are associated with the community of, you know, supposedly concerned people about climate change, if you don't support the public policies that they believe naturally flow from that, then you're anti-science, you're a backward rube, you're a moron, you're not even entitled to an opinion. Like, your opinion isn't even worth refuting, because don't you know that everybody believes such and such? They've gone from claiming that there's a consensus about, let's say, the trend in global temperatures to exactly what needs to be done, when, by whom, and with which policy. And that's a matter of your own individual values. Quote unquote, science doesn't tell you there has to be this mitigation measure implemented or that one, because you have to judge that according to your own values. Well, if we implement this measure, we're likely to do more damage than good. There is no science that tells you you have to choose A, B, or C. Choosing A, B, and C is a philosophical question that you resolve in part by using the information that science gives you, but science, in quotation marks, doesn't come ready-made with a bunch of policy solutions to it.
No, exactly. And I think there's two bits to your question there. One is to recognize that any policy decision is a trade-off. So in the book I make, and I think it's a good metaphor, if you ask transport scientists, what is the best way to avoid any traffic fatalities? Remember, about 40,000 people die in the US every year on the road, and what, 46,000 in the EU. So it's a huge problem. It's a man-made problem, and we know entirely how to fix it. One of the solutions they would probably suggest is you should just put the speed limit at 3 miles an hour. Then nobody dies, except maybe from boredom. Right? The fundamental point is you can obviously set a speed limit at 3 miles an hour, but you would also have a huge amount of cost in other areas. You wouldn't be able to go to see your friends or family. You wouldn't be able to have a continentally integrated economy. There'd be a lot of things that you couldn't do at 3 miles an hour. So the reality is human societies say, sure, we should not, if you're not Germany. We never say you can just drive as fast as you want, but we never say you should only go 3 miles an hour. We find somewhere in between that trade off the fact that you both like to be able to get there fast and you'd like to not have so many people die. We find a speed limit that's 55 or 85 miles an hour in the US, but not one that is 3 miles an hour. That's part of the conversation that we need. The other part, of course, is that when people talk about science, they almost exclusively talk about natural science. And natural science is an incredibly important part of the climate debate, but it's not the only one. You absolutely also need the social sciences, because you can't just look at, will there be more fire, for instance, if you don't think about, well, how are people going to change their built-up environment? You can't just talk about, will there be more flooding, unless you also look at how much will societies, for instance, build dikes or make them higher? So constantly we have to ask, what does the social sciences tell us both about what we will be doing, but also about the costs of these impacts? So for instance, it's not enough to know that 3 miles an hour won't mean that there will be any people dying from traffic-related deaths. You also need to ask, well, how much will that reduce growth, or possibly even our economy? You know, it's not implausible that that would severely dent our ability to produce anything we'd like, so that we will end up poor, so that a lot more people will die from lack of affordable healthcare and availability of healthcare, and even availability of just getting to the hospital in time. You need to have all of those questions answered as well. So we should both ask for the natural sciences to tell us how much will sea level rise. We should also have the social sciences tell us how much will that cost and how much will we adapt to it. And then we need the answer to, well, if we do climate policy, how much will we cut those costs from flooding versus how much will that climate policy cost us? It's a complicated conversation. It's not something that hasn't been answered, but obviously this is vastly outside the, we're all going to die and we just need to buy all of these solar panels and wind turbines, which is the easy but not the correct answer.
And of course, it's very, very unlikely you're going to get to a good answer in an atmosphere of hysteria. Yes. And another thing is, it seems when it's posed that way, that it's the end of the world if we do nothing. But on the other hand, we have these series of policy proposals. Well, who wouldn't just choose the policy proposals almost sight unseen if those are the choices? And so what results from that are people who costlessly post things on Facebook, like on their profile picture. Maybe it'll say something like climate action now. They have no idea what that means, but all they know is if there isn't climate action, it really is the end of the world. They've been told all kinds of panicked things. Their kids have been panicked. And yet I've seen somebody I know personally put climate action now, who the increase in her energy prices that would result from the current approaches to how to do this would be very hard for her to manage. And I'm sure she's not even aware of them. So she's not even in a position to decide what is the best approach to this. And likewise, of course, that's all the worse in the developing world. We can't just say, well, we have this blanket approach that we should take and we'll just implement it, when the lack of access to inexpensive energy is one of the biggest problems faced by the developing world. So again, we have to decide, how do we solve what is perceived by some people to be a problem without causing worse problems? I mean, that has to be, it has to be a do no harm approach, or minimize the harm. Let's say this, even I fell into it just now. There really is there is no do no harm. It's a harm minimization approach we're trying to take.
Or welfare maximization, I would hope it's rather, because minimizing is almost sure to, you know, constrain almost all of your impacts. One way we compensate that is by basically giving people compensation if they're put in very bad positions. But yes, absolutely. And I think one of the things that we're realizing, certainly in Europe, but also I think in China, you're seeing that, is that asking for strong climate policies suddenly also means that this is going to be expensive. It's not surprising when you ask for expensive climate policies, you're going to end up having expensive, for instance, energy. And when people start seeing that, they say, oh, wait a minute, that was not what I wanted. So, you know, it's fun to see when you ask people, they almost universally say, global warming is a huge problem, we should definitely do something about it. And then you ask them, how much are you willing to pay for it? And it turns out that, you know, people are typically not willing to pay more than a couple of $100 per year. And even that is somewhat contentious, because it's typically, it's an average of say 5-10% who are willing to pay thousands of dollars and probably can also afford to do so, and some who just claim that they would be willing to do it. And a lot of people were not willing to pay anything. A new survey in Australia showed that 43% of all people they asked were not willing to pay a cent. And so what you're really up against here is there is very little willingness to pay. And so you end up with politicians making promises for the future that everyone knows they can't keep. So not only do we end up with poor policies that will eventually alienate large parts of the electorate, but we're also not fixing the problem with smart policies right now. And so, you know, if I can just take 30 seconds more to talk about what is actually the smart policy. What I try to say in the book is the main policy that's going to fix climate change is the same policy that's fixed most problems for humanity. It's not telling everyone you have to do with less, because that will never win sustained elections. It is a policy of innovation. If we can, and I'm putting this bluntly and very simplistically, if we could find and innovate a way to produce green energy cheaper than fossil fuels, we'd be done. Everyone would switch, not just rich, well-meaning Americans and Europeans, but everybody else, the Chinese, the Indians, the Africans. So the simple point here is, if you could come up with a way with solar and an enormous amount of batteries, or fission, you know, normal nuclear, or fusion, or any other of the many, many proposals that are out there that produce energy cheaper than fossil fuels, we'd be done. If we don't, we will continuously be having these conversations where we try to force everyone to pay much more than they're willing to do. So I simply think we have been missing the main point of the climate conversation by throwing everything at solar and wind, which is nice, but is not going to solve the climate problem by itself, instead of throwing most of the money, much cheaper, much more effective, at R&D into green energy.
All right, well, we're going to leave it there. And I generally like, when I have an author on We Talk for Half an Hour. Makes me happy because I feel like people are more inclined to buy the book than if we had spoken for 3 hours and they'd feel like, oh, all right, I basically got the whole book. But no. This is just tantalizing enough that you say, well, I think I need to flip through this thing. So the book, of course, is False Alarm, How Climate Change Panic Costs Us Trillions, Hurts the Poor, and Fails to Fix the Planet by our guest Bjorn Lomborg. I'll link to it on our show notes page, tomwoods.com/1993. And thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thomas, it's great to be on.
All right, folks, before we go today, I wanted to say a big thank you to everyone who attended the 2000th episode event in Orlando over the weekend. We had 2,500 people in attendance. And let me tell you something, as somebody who has been part of many, many events over the decades, I can tell you it is extremely difficult to get even a fraction of that number to attend an event like this. So very gratifying, very, very happy. I got to meet a great many of you. And in fact, because we just kept running out of time at the different receptions to get books signed and pictures taken, I told people on the spot that I would be there after the program was over as long as it took for everybody to be able to do whatever it was they wanted in terms of pictures and books and so on and so forth. So I was there till a little after 2 a.m, then ran out and got a very late bite to eat with my old friend Michael Malice, whom I have not seen in person since before the whole COVID thing, which is unbelievable. By far the longest we've ever gone without seeing each other. So that was it was just a wonderful experience. It was great. I did not have Scott Horton on the bill. I wanted to keep him a surprise for you guys. That's not Michael Malice's surprise. It's my surprise. Lynn Ulbricht was another surprise. But Scott, of course, is our great foreign policy expert. And boy, did he take being a secret guest really seriously. His wife and daughter checked into the hotel, but he stayed off-site until immediately before showtime. And then he was escorted behind the stage area through some doors not available to the public so that no one would see him going backstage. And wow, people were not expecting him. And what an ovation he got. And it was so deserved. And backstage, we were being told just how many people were there. And Scott was so excited. He said, wow, man, biggest crowd I ever spoke to was like 200. So it was a lot of fun for all of us. I don't want to give anything away in terms of how certain games we played turned out. You'll just have to see for yourselves. Doc Dixon, the magician, absolutely stole the show. When the episode comes out, we will edit it appropriately for a listening audience because there were some aspects that were visual and that wouldn't make sense with audio, so we'll cut those out. But if you want to see the entire production, you'll want to see the video. And so the video will post on the show notes page for the 2000th episode. So don't worry, I'll explain all this when the time comes, but it was a wonderful night. It went on longer than I thought because doggone it, everybody went over their time. But it was extremely gratifying. I saw so many friends, so many people I have known in the Liberty Movement, people I haven't seen for years in some cases. Some of them came long distances. We had people from all 50 states, plus the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, as well as 8 countries. And that's in the face of all the crazy travel restrictions out there. So that's really, really an amazing thing. So I am so, so grateful to everybody. And now if you think about this with a big fancy resort ballroom and receptions with hors d'oeuvres and drinks and big AV team with 2 giant video screens and then all the guests, obviously I covered everybody's airfare and paid people and stuff. This cost way, way more than you probably think it cost, but it was well worth it because I feel like we needed a night, not where we're getting lectures about liberty. You know, we need a night where we're just being human together and enjoying each other's company and having fun, having some laughs after everything we've been put through. That was the purpose of it. The purpose was not to spread liberty to other people. The purpose was not to appeal to non-listeners of the show. I tried to do that in other occasions. This was exclusively for our people. That's what the event was for, was a big thank you to everybody for listening and supporting me all this time and to just celebrate being human after an inhuman year and a half. That was the entire point of it. And I think we succeeded tremendously in that. It was a great time. Everybody enjoyed themselves. So look forward to that. We'll be getting to that. Of course, this is episode 1993. So it won't be too long before we get that one out. We're going to be doing just 4 instead of 5 episodes this week and the week following to give my audiovisual team a little extra time to do the work necessary on the video and audio for the 2000th episode to get it ready for you guys. But it is coming, and I hope you enjoy it. as the folks in attendance did. All right, everybody, thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.